I could say salt, I could say eggs, I could say pasta, I could say bacon, and you know what I'm talking about? And you would say, yeah, I understand those things.
Carbonara.
Carbonara, I could say carbonara. Yeah.
Hey there, if you've joined the podcast today, my name is Chris Jarvis. I work with companies on employee giving and volunteering programs.
And my name's Jake McIsaac. I spend a lot of time thinking about public safety and restorative justice.
So we are having conversations here that we've been having for 20 years.
Yeah, the only difference now is we press record and share it with you.
Thanks for joining us.
We are together in the same
room. We're together in the same room recording the last episode here.
We had a great experience this week. I flew to Baltimore to hang out with Chris and the team at Realized Worth, and we spend a lot of time talking about how those last few days have gone.
We're going to tell you all about it. We're going to tell you about going to West Baltimore. We're going to tell you about our own disorienting dilemmas and a guy named Don. Let's get into it.
We're in Baltimore. I'm in Baltimore. You're always in Baltimore.
And we are recording together, obviously in the same place. You came down from Halifax to be here for a week of Social Rev.
Social Rev.
Social Rev. Okay, yeah. So we'll talk a little bit about Social Rev, and we're going to talk a little bit about why we do it. Like, what is it? Why we do it? Who we do it with? And the kind of fun thing angle that you were able to bring to it as well. But specifically, I think the thing we were thinking of talking about had to do with the community piece with Don.
Yeah, what we ended up doing. Before we get too far in, I wanted to just say thanks for including me in that. This was a really cool experience to be part of that first Social Rev gathering. And what was cool is I don't work in the space. Like, so I bumped into a whole bunch of folks who attended the conference, and I was like, I felt like the interloper, like the guy who was just didn't know anything. So I was asking a whole bunch of stupid questions to people.
But it came across as, very interested, very in the zone, present. It came across very present.
I think it was because it was authentic. You know, when you normally go to something like this and people are asking questions like, so what do you do?
Yeah.
And you're asking about business.
Yeah.
I was genuinely interested.
Yeah.
Because I just didn't know what people did.
Well, and the thing is, and this is what we're going to explore today, is how a lot of the work that we're doing in the with the private sector, looking to promote pro-social behavior in the workplace, primarily expressed through volunteering and giving, uses almost all the same principles as restorative approach to justice and community safety. And I want to hopefully have enough space where you can share some of what you've been dealing with this week.
Yeah, for sure.
And how these two things strangely share a lot of these same principles and values and maybe point of view.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the conference.
Okay.
What's the dream? Like, what was the idea? Okay. What was it?
First of all, it is not a conference. That was a setup. He meant to do that.
Sure. Right over the plate.
It wasn't a conference in that it was not primarily an exchange of ideas or knowledge. What it was it it was a group of people who, for the most part, were highly curated, meaning they understood, they had some basic understanding of or competencies in transformative approach to volunteering and giving. And they were all from the corporate social responsibility space, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so they were the experience.
It felt like a boutique experience.
Yeah.
Like very much, like the going to the, department store, big box store kind of conference. So you're right. I think conference is probably the wrong word because it didn't feel like that. How many folks would you say were there?
There was 60 people, 63 people, most of whom, about 50 of whom were the practitioners. Right. And the reason I say it's an immersive learning experience or an immersive experience is because the focal point was an experience we had volunteering in the community in West Baltimore.
It's awesome.
And there was a bit of a lead up to that. And then there was a lot of reflection, critical reflection in that. And when I say people were the event, what I mean is what they experienced and how they made sense of that experience was by and large the content of the experience, meaning just what they saw and what they thought about what they saw is the information that was exchanged. We did spend some time kind of doing some upfront work in giving some vocab and some concepts and sort of, I think you use the word bumper sometimes, to help people navigate what they're experiencing and working to understand. But that's just the side banks of a river. It is not the river. They were the river, and the river was the experience. And it was phenomenal because they were phenomenal.
When you're talking about it, I should give some qualifiers. I have been to Baltimore in the past, but never out of downtown or like the harbor area. Right. But it feels really, really cool to be down here walking around. It's very close, very touristy. I don't know if that's right, but it's kind of a mixed. It's like a tourist destination, but residents are out walking around. Everyone's walking their dogs, saying good morning. Mm-hmm. Feels a lot like what I'm used to in Halifax, actually. Mm-hmm. Like really friendly folks.
Mm-hmm. The thing about Halifax, I think for me, it's like if Toronto's density of residential population in the middle of the city, Toronto's wonderful for that.
Yeah.
Halifax had more of that. I think that's what it would feel like because we'd be on the ocean. You have some of the maritime sensibilities, whatnot. But yeah, it's great. It's a great place to be.
So I was not ready for, given all of that, I was not ready for West Baltimore. That was, that was a disorienting dilemma for me.
Yeah.
It did not meet my expectations when I got there, and I have never been in a place like that before.
Yeah. And Baltimore is constructed in such a way that you could live here and never ever have to see it.
Yeah.
And this is a result of redlining and then compounding systemic decisions coming out of a system that doesn't care one way or the other, but it's designed by people who do unconsciously or consciously do care. And so that reflection carries on. But yeah, let's talk about what that experience was like for you. Baltimore is incredibly integrated in terms of Black, white community and whatnot. But even with that, you see a stark contrast. And so we leave where I live, which has a lot of Black, white community and other aspects of the community. But now we're going to go to an extreme.
So I leaned into some of my, the way I work on the everyday is thinking about crime prevention, and particularly a lens, crime prevention through environmental design. It's called SEPTED. And there are a few SEPTED principles.
What does it stand for?
Crime prevention through environmental design. And it looks, crime prevention.
You go by, and I try to steal this stuff all the time so I can use it. But this one might be a bridge too
far. It'll be hard. Yeah.
Crime prevention through environmental
design. So it looks at, the theory is, it looks at the built environment and its ability to affect behavioral change in a crime prevention way, or
passively even. Like passively, there's no active, crime. Right.
Well, there's a bit of active. I'll explain the points, but mostly it's an analysis and maybe a roadmap for figuring out a way forward. So if you look at a community and you look at some of the five key areas of crime prevention through environmental design, one is sight lines or surveillance. So it could be lighting, it could be cameras, it could be organized patrol. It's
what you're trying to avoid, are dark spots in the alley where something
could happen. Or a neighborhood watch.
Yeah.
An organized patrol.
Like,
are people engaged in this work?
So you're being seen.
Being seen
in neighborhoods.
You know that someone's watching, someone's looking, someone
or
might
at least that's the overall impression, right? Like somebody's, I can't because somebody might see me.
Right. So surveillance. The second one is territorial reinforcement. Territorial reinforcement is one of these about what does it look like? Does it look like the general condition of the neighborhood is well kept? That people here care about the condition? So if you walk by a place that's it has broken windows, and this is where broken window theory is seated in, this kind of idea.
Is that actually a thing, yeah, broken window theory?
Broken window theory is that if coming out of like a lot of Bill Bratton's work, Commissioner Bratton in NYPD, the precursor to Comstat, and this big intelligence-led, like data-driven policing, if you could get enough data points, what would it tell you? It would tell you that if you chase the broken windows, if you chase the things like in the subways, people who jump the turnstiles,
yeah,
go after that, you'll get the muggers. You'll get the people who are doing graffiti.
Okay, wait. So if it sort of a lead indicator could be jumping turnstiles, it has nothing to do with the muggings that I'm trying to pay attention to.
Right.
But those two things correlate. And broken windows tend to correlate with higher crime rates.
Higher crime rates. Neighborhoods that have fallen into disrepair, either because, well, generally, I don't think crime prevention folks think about the role that systems play in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually like,
really?
The people in the neighborhood have let this place go,
yeah,
and be run down.
Yeah.
So it's very judgy. Some approaches to it.
Yeah.
But you don't have to take that approach. You could also equally say, and I think we would say this, is look at how the community, look at how the city has abandoned this community.
Yes.
So you look at the state, the built environment, the lighting, the bushes. Are they well cared for? Is anyone mowing the ground?
It's true. Anymore? I mean, it's true. Like the overgrown sidewalks and whatnot would not be tolerated in other parts of the city.
Absolutely not. Because why?
Well, I might cut taxes. Them down. I pay taxes. I might cut them down. But I also have neighbors who would get on the phone,
right,
and call somebody until somebody showed up. And they wouldn't take many phone calls for them to show up.
Right. So territorial reinforcement is, what does that look like? Does the environment look clean, clear, clear of debris, that kind of thing? Well cared for. Access control is, how do people come in and out? Like, what are the routes in, and what are those routes in like? So it could be a roadway, it could be this a walking path.
Access control.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is, we've got the first one was just
surveillance.
Territorial reinforcement.
And we have access control.
Access control. So how, coming in and getting out.
Coming in, getting out. How many roadways? How is it laid out? It could be walking paths. Are there walking paths? Does it encourage people to move about the community in a particular way? Have they cut off for, you know, sometimes policing strategies are to cut off and create these kettle points where you create a block at the end of a roadway or a block at the end of an alley so that you kind of a dead end. So
this isn't going anywhere, so people can't cut.
And okay, if you don't know the neighborhood, you might run into those dead ends, and police know those things. So sometimes you can control, right, the built environment, right, by saying, we better know all the ways in, all the way out, where these roads lead. Mm-hmm. And there's some strategy to that. But you want to pay attention to it because you don't think about that. When you leave your house, you can go left, you can go right, mm-hmm, you can go any which way. You pay attention to the ways in. So let's use those three for now. I wanted to see, on our way to West Baltimore, without ever being there, and what I knew is it was going to be economically depressed. I knew that it was going to be, we were going to be volunteering in a community that
there may
was,
be more spray paint on walls.
I imagined that I would have some indicators, but yeah, I wanted to pay attention to those three principles. Mm-hmm. Would I know when we were getting close? We jumped in a shuttle and we started to drive.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely knew when we were within a couple blocks.
Right.
The road all of a sudden got really rough. It was not well paved. Like when we got,
yeah, off.
You remember,
true,
that?
Yeah.
It got really, really bumpy.
Let's get really bumpy.
And I looked out of the window and I saw a tire by the side of the road.
Yeah.
And I saw garbage bags and overgrown bushes. And I knew from my SEPTED training, we must be close.
Yeah.
These are the indicators of a community that has been left on its own. Has been abandoned.
That has been left on its own. Abandoned. We put some things in place to manage it for our benefit, and whatever happens.
Knowing that the history of redlining and
we want to get into
raising more, the taxes in certain communities,
yeah,
and valuing white neighborhoods over black neighborhoods or historically black neighborhoods, so that you can't sell this house now. You can't generate generational wealth. You can't start to get ahead ever. So that disparity between between groups of residents of Baltimore started to get bigger and bigger. But I knew just from driving up that we were getting close.
Yeah.
And it was pretty, it was sad to me that it was so predictable.
So when you see those indicators, and just say them out loud for us.
Surveillance. Access control. And
access control.
Territorial reinforcement.
Territorial reinforcement. What are the other letters?
Crime prevention through environmental design.
SEPT. Crime prevention through environmental design. SEPT.
Yeah.
When you see those things in place, do you think intention or do you think just the way it is?
I think that we have all of those things at play in my neighborhood and I never, ever have to think about it because they're well kept, they're mm-hmm. well cared for. Mm-hmm. I never have to worry about whether there's a stop sign at the end of my road because I know that if it came down, they would put a stop sign back right. up. When we got to West Baltimore, I saw it leaning over the side.
Probably
I saw
no street
signs. So you can't actually do wayfinding there. You could get lost.
Yeah.
If you're from there, you know what street you're on. But if you're mm-hmm. a visitor, but rarely they're not encouraging people to come in. Right. There's no sense of welcome.
There is no reason. Like
no
said,
welcome.
The sign. Intention that I think is there is not in the system itself. It comes, the intention came from the people who bit by bit have put it together. And redlining, and I said I want to come back to this, redlining is a good example of this. And we used it in the breach a little bit, referenced it. Because for those of you who don't know, it'll be in the show notes. You can check it out. The one I want to put in there is from Adam Ruins Everything about redlining. It's really quite good. And Baltimore is the birthplace of redlining.
Yeah.
Where they drew up covenants so that nobody who was Black or Black descent could buy a home in this neighborhood, or Jewish. Now, the Jewish one was negotiable when economically times were tough. We would let Jewish folks in there. Otherwise, but the part about the Black community didn't happen. They were never allowed in. And so redlining also was about, well, can you get a loan if you're trying to buy a house in an area you're not supposed to be in? And if you buy houses in the area you're allowed to live in, it's automatically high risk. Yeah. So everything was put in place to just make it so you couldn't own property in the better parts of town, which would gain value, and that where you could live was very difficult to. And because of these pieces of sort of security control for the rest of us to keep those people in their place. And I know when I say it out loud, it sounds awful. And that I believe there's some sort of nefarious Moriarty on the other end, like in Sherlock Holmes stories, pulling all the strings, making all the evil happen in the world. There's no Satan here. There's no devil. There's no Moriarty.
They.
No, right. There's just the little contributions we make during our lives towards bigotry and racism. Most of my life, I'm good, but I just made a little contribution here or there, a little bylaw here or there, a little vote here or there, a little way of being, a little bit of negligence, I'm not bothering to look. And all of those little things together are what we call the system. And so I do say we decided because I'm part of it, I want to be or not.
Can I offer maybe a slightly different perspective?
Please, because this leaves me in a fairly gross place.
What if the lack of diversity, the lack of access to other perspectives and people when some of these things were in place only allowed people to think about their in-group. And so their own group of people, the us,
mm-hmm.
were hardwired to think about protecting the us.
Mm-hmm.
What if we were more charitable to those folks because of the way that
our
we're
ancestors,
all,
our previous generations,
your ancestors. What if we, sorry, we're both Canadians. Neither of our ancestors.
That's
but what if we were more charitable to them and thought they were making the best decisions at the time to protect the group that they believed were them, the
or
us.
That they had ever
right?
felt any empathy in the first place. Like they just didn't know.
Taxpayers were saying you have to protect the value of our property, it probably felt like a reasonable strategy if you weren't hearing from anyone else. Like the danger of an echo chamber yeah. of only hearing from that's your own thing. Folks.
That's the real danger is the echo chamber where you right. only hear from your own folks. So I think what you're positing is that there wasn't an entire generation of Nazis living right. before us, looking for every occasion they could to squash. And it was fairly passive and ignorant participation, yeah. right? In the base, because as you already said, our hard wiring leads us to this eventuality without being attentive, without being intentional. If we do not ever think I must evolve with intention,
right,
we will follow 200,000-year-old systems of thinking.
So you want to make sure that the schools that your kids go to are safe,
yes,
are well-funded,
yeah.
are clean,
yeah.
are on streets that are well-paved, and there's good lighting, and the bushes are...
Why
so,
not?
And then you have limited resources. So you can't do everything, so you have to make tough decisions. We do this every day in our own lives, in our own families. The principles have to be scalable. And so I think the risk is if you don't have enough access to people to push back in helpful ways, not just in protesting and demanding. Those are important, very important strategies at certain points of time, at moments in history. But I think we need it on the everyday so that we don't have to get to the place where we have to overcorrect. It just keeps, those are the bumpers that I mean when we're right. talking about it.
Right. Okay. So in my mind, this brings us back to Social Rev Live and this, not a conference, but a curated experience yeah. of people within different contexts for these experiences. So we're on the bus, we're driving to West Baltimore, and we're going to meet with an organization that represents different communities and brings volunteers and resources to bear where and when as needed, but in a very thoughtful way mm-hmm. because they are the community and it is a break a difference. Again, in the show notes, there'll be more information.
That was awesome.
Together with a business that was looking at these communities as a business opportunity by focusing on folks who would normally, this many years later, after redlining is now illegal, this many years later, still cannot get past the barrier that redlining created in the first place. Because guess what? These neighborhoods are now high risk. Right. And the people who want to move into them because of generations of being redlined and kept out of owning property to break generational poverty still are coming at it even further behind now. They can't even access a neighborhood that nobody really wants to live in. It's right. it's weird how at the first it kept people out and now just it's on automatic pilot. It just works on its own now. A phenomenal thing. But this organization, Parity, has come in and decided that they could rehab some of these houses and make them available to the community that has had a hard time accessing them. And in that, there is a business opportunity.
And one of the things that, and we have to put Parity as well in the show notes, but one of the things that they talked about, and I learned not being from Baltimore, were the numbers. That Parity was working with trying to rehab about 30 to 40 homes
yeah.
for people to return back to the community
yeah.
in really beautiful way that we'll make sure that it's very clear in the notes. But they also said it's a drop in the bucket given the housing crisis in Baltimore, particularly around affordable housing and the crisis for unhoused folks within Baltimore.
Yeah, because access to housing across the country now is in crisis.
Everywhere.
Yes.
And in Baltimore, they had 30,000 vacant lots and 15,000 properties, houses that were still standing but empty in various states of disrepair and really collapsing on inside like
barely a house.
Like barely. Like maybe
you can see what used to be there.
Two yeah. of four walls, maybe.
Yeah, yeah
but, exactly. But the shell of a house.
That's 45,000 spots where homes could exist for people yeah. who need homes.
Yeah.
They're there already. It's already, there's streets around there. There's sewage. It's all in place.
But the taxes aren't paid.
And all that just is a blind automated process too. Now you can get abatements and you can get them down from the tens or hundreds of thousands down to hundreds of dollars in some wow. cases. But it's difficult. It's less difficult because groups like Parity and Break a Difference, not them maybe in particular, but other groups have worked with the city to come up with ways to get through these friction points, because it's an area that how many people care about who are the voters or the main group that are living in the main parts of the city, the non-West Baltimores. But it has gotten attention. It has gotten a little bit better. Love to put some info in about that as well. Now it's just making it happen. That's all I was going to say. And Parity is trying to make it happen. And I know it's not a simple like, oh, well, here's the solution. Let's do that. And it's all going to be over. And I do want to bring in like to the conversation also what it meant for 50 middle class corporate America folks to show up.
Because we have struggled, I know, going back 20 years doing some of this work together, always trying to be careful about introducing the community.
Yeah.
Introducing communities. It's like trying to mix up your friend group. You want them to see, see the good in both.
In both, even though they have nothing in common sometimes. And then
we become the social bridge and we're trying to do that. And I think that's an important role. And we do that through a brief and really helping people be thoughtful about the experience. Mm-hmm. And an immersive experience does that in terms of social bridging. But we often are stuck with not wanting to be exploitative.
Yeah.
This is not a zoo.
Or even a peer.
Yeah, or this is not poverty porn. Like where you can come down.
Which is a real thing, poverty porn.
Yeah, of course. Just, where you can come and get your pictures, wear your t-shirts, say that you were there, feel good for a day and take off. Like don't want to do that.
I'm not saying anybody's doing it. Like it's just
that's not what that intention ignorance. But I think it's a helpful thing in the background to be, that we are constantly thinking about. Don't do that. Don't replicate it.
Don't model it.
And be always aware. And we're probably hyper-vigilant to it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when other people aren't thinking about it. And that's what I learned when I went there. I was really, really worried about it. Because I asked one of the residents, what do you think when all these white people...
Oh, yeah.
What do you think when all these white folks come downtown?
Yes, absolutely.
And I was like really worried that what he was thinking was, here they come, all these saviors coming in to save our community.
Okay, so you see... obviously black, about 40 years old ish,
58. He told me,
Okay, and he's lived in West Baltimore most of his life,
lived there his whole life. Was really, really open about what he was thinking, what his observations have been over the course of his lifetime. Said that he hasn't left the city, he's been sort of in Baltimore his whole life, and particularly in that community. And told a really hopeful story of people coming in. At the same time, a very real and gritty, right now, here's what it's like.
Right.
So could glimpse the future, could see the value of people coming, but people coming in on this particular day to do the work with these organizations didn't make one bit of difference that day to him.
So what
were we doing?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Set up what we're doing.
Okay.
And I'll tell you more about why he said that.
Okay. That's good. So, working with the community and working with organizations that understand this community and broader community issues, we showed up for about an hour and a half of work. We all put on our gear, masks and everything.
White Tyvek suits, make sure that we were safe from the lead paint that is rampant in all of these old houses,
obviously, and when they were built and how they were cared for, and then just the dust and as often as they can, groups of volunteers come in and help with the demolition and cleanup because they're pretty beat up inside. Yeah. There's lots of garbage and refuse, so we gather up the ideas that we would gather up all this garbage as volunteers, thereby bringing the cost down to rehab the house for Parity, thereby bringing the cost down and increasing the profit for the business so it can keep growing in scale. We need Parity to grow in scale because it's not a philanthropic model. And yet we are partnering with them as a bit of a social enterprise to drive those prices down. But we are just one day in a long number of days and hundreds of volunteers who get to now come in and be a part of creating this value. It's not just going to be value when you put it up for sale and money comes from a bank to a bank. There's value in creation here that we participate in, but then take away with us. And we can convert that into social capital by talking about it and sharing it, and reflecting on it and critically evaluating it and seeing how it might change my decision so that I may do more of this going forward. So the model is phenomenal. But these are leaders in the CSR space, and they really wanted to see what they needed to be considering for their own programs at their own companies. And this was the way for them to access that knowledge experientially. So they all, it's more complex than we're going to share right now. But it is basically real volunteering, really hard volunteering with real community members, and everything that we do from the brief to the debrief, setting up the disorienting dilemma to ask them to experience what it would be like if they were in this situation or they were part of this community, right back to what did you experience today? Was it what you expected? So that they could kind of maybe just resolve the disorienting dilemma, which is the name of this podcast. And is hopefully every episode we do has some aspect of disorienting dilemma, because that's what invites us to learn in a right. sustainable manner. So that's what we were doing there. And then after an hour and a half, we had a bit of food with the neighbors, which is great. We did it with people around us, with people alongside of us. Break a Difference brought their own. They're from
awesome.
That community.
That was awesome.
Yeah. He's from that community. So we did it. It was very with Pasha. We weren't doing it to them. We weren't doing it for them. We were doing it alongside. Then we all get back in our vans and left, because that was our highest level contribution for that day. That's what we could do on that day in that moment. But it's not the end, obviously.
Right. We focused on the building, and rightfully so, and what that could mean, and eventually thinking about a family that might move in there.
Yeah.
And the really focusing on the story, trying to, with help in during the brief and with help from the folks on the ground, to constantly put at the front of our mind, the task significance was, we're moving this so other people can move in.
Moving
all of this refuge and all of the debris to make space for their hopes, their dreams.
Yeah.
We were not the first people in. You like that?
Yeah, I do like that.
You can use that.
Yeah.
They were moving in and they'd already been there. The people, this is what we understand, is that the people for whom would eventually see this place have already been in there and started to glimpse the future. But there's a long way from the first view to where they, when they get the keys and walk
you
in.
Would not believe, well, maybe you would, but I mean, it was as bad as it could get.
I've never experienced anything like that. But what I was surprised by, and maybe I shouldn't be,
dead animals and everything.
Yeah. Was what this gentleman told me was he didn't actually talk about the built environment at all. And when I tried to point out some SEPTED principles to him, he laughed them off. And I'll tell you what he did tell me was about the people.
Okay.
He told me about the neighborhood, not about the buildings in the neighborhood. And when I asked, was it okay? And what did he think about all of these folks, predominantly white folks, coming into a black neighborhood to do this work? I expected him to bristle at it.
Yeah.
He didn't. Thought it was really important that folks came down and saw that this was still happening, that the state of the city, because it's really easy to drive around it and to never have to see this.
Yeah.
So it's good that people come down here and see how we're living, what's going on.
And so, because I mean, ignore is one thing, but completely forget.
Right. But it's hard to leave there and then forget it. So coming down,
hard to. There's nobody who could do that physiologically.
No,
you'd need some sort of induced. I don't know how you do it. You're not going to forget that.
It's sensory overload. You look everywhere. And so he thought, and which was interesting because we talk a lot about this. He didn't have all of the neuroscience behind it, but he knew that experience was going to be important for people to leave here and take back. Mm-hmm. He didn't articulate it in a way that. That he said what the next steps would be, but he believed that this was going to be an important thing. it was important that people came and saw this and knew that this is how we live. And then he said, it's really important because we have to remember that people are coming in. All of the old folks are gone. All of the seniors, all of our elders are gone. So I asked him, I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? He said, in this neighborhood, it's a generalization, but it was his, these are his observations. He said, we have grandmothers. Many of the grandmothers are like 30 to 35 years old. And that gutted me because I started to think about my own experience and the value of older Black folks in my neighborhood back in Halifax and what that meant to the community.
Right.
When he said that, that closed the distance between Halifax and Baltimore instantly for me in a shared experience.
Right.
In a moment, he told me everything about what it must be like to live here.
Right.
Lack of elders, lack of people who could go out and be the matriarchs of these families.
They have some sort of platform of lived experience, yeah, authority from that to speak.
And to where people would listen.
Right.
So who would be the people that they would listen to? And so he said,
otherwise, how do you have any cohesion in a community around?
You can't have cohesion, but there's no structure. There's it seemed lack of family structure, which if we thought about, particularly in the Black community, some of those core structures may have been the family, the church, the schools. Like those things have been in place for good or for bad. They are these key structures that kept propping up the community
with
some order. And he described for me, just by saying that, a really precarious position for the community and not having those wise older leaders.
Yeah.
Then he said,
yeah,
I looked up at a sign. So this is territorial reinforcement. It talked about crime prevention, kind of pointed to neighborhood watch. It said something like see something, say something, or one of these things that would encourage people to call the Baltimore police if you see a crime in progress. Right. And I looked up and I kind of said it with a smile, but I was also curious. I said, so how does this work then? This sign here, and I pointed to it, and he said, well, he said it in a really great Baltimore way. He said, shit, just like off the wire. He's like, that'd get you killed here. See something, say something, that would get you killed. He said, you know what? That's what the old grandmothers would do. That's who those signs were for. No one here would do that now.
Wow.
Those folks would come out and they would yell at you and they'd tell you to go home, go to school, go, you know, they're going to talk to your parents, or I'm calling the police.
Yeah.
And now we have none of that. No one calls the police. We wouldn't call the police. And he said, we just mind our business.
Keep your head down.
Describe just a neighborhood that has no connection.
Yeah.
They're surviving together. They have a common experience. They walk past the same buildings. They know each other by name, maybe have same family names, but it is not a connected community. And he was telling that story and it was gutting to me, actually. Yeah. Even though we were doing great work on the building, it left me really, really sad about his, and he didn't say it for sympathy. It was just matter of fact.
Right. Yeah, I'm just telling you the way it is, Jake.
Yeah, exactly.
Then we go into day two. And in day two, like, why did we do this in the first place? Why go and do this volunteering? That's a really important question to ask. And our answer is always so that we can trigger neuroplasticity in the brain so that we can grow new neural pathways as a result of critical reflection on an experience whereby we assign meaning to that experience that allows us to see the world slightly differently.
Right.
We can only see the world the way our brains are wired. And each one of us has a wiring of the brain that is absolutely unique to you. So nobody else sees the world the way you do. Obviously, nobody's lived exactly the same life you've lived. And the neural wiring is basically a configuration of how you have lived your life and your ancestors have lived their lives. So that being said, getting into that and tinkering with it allows us to kind of evolve with some intention to become the version of ourselves that we wish we were. Or even to have experiences whereby we can explore aspects of being alive in the world that we didn't know were available before. And that's kind of how I started my journey. I had an experience and somebody asked me a question that I couldn't answer, and I'm off on a new direction in life. That was all it took. I call that epiphany. But we want to create, what was the phrase we were using? We want proximity to the other is the practice.
Right.
Hospitable space whereby we can all be truly who we are is the mechanism by which we can have that proximity. And in that space, we practice the principle of hospitality so that we are intentionally viewing our own actions and interpreting those of others in a generous way.
Right.
As opposed to assuming the worst, right? About ourselves or others. And this hopefully results in a way of seeing ourselves as so that we can recognize and receive belonging when and as it occurs. And that's really what the human experience is about, is where did we see that just the other day? To be human is to be accepted.
Right.
Because something that is not even human doesn't deserve, it's inhumane. All of our language is about so not even being no value. Even, or the value can be
not even
negotiated.
Not even reading it as humane. I don't even see it and recognize it.
Recognize it as humane. But to be human is to belong and to have a shared identity and to be necessary, a necessary part of. And so belonging for us may be the ultimate test of someone's humanity from my perspective. Do they have an opportunity to belong? And if they don't, maybe I don't see them as human.
As you're talking, I'm listening to you set that up, and I'm hearing the science speak that is all behind what this gentleman hoped would happen with the visit.
Mm-hmm.
He hoped that people would leave, and somehow they would make a connection, but it was really important for them to come down and see. I think that's what we spent day two doing with intention, is making sure that stuff happened by walking folks through three lenses.
Yeah, these lenses, and intentionally we use that word, so that you could bring meaning to the experience with sort of a guided way. And so it's the first lens that we look back on that experience and our entire lives on, with to some degree, was from programs to social movements.
Yeah.
Because for our community, we think a lot about programs. We have an employee volunteering program. We might even give it a name, ACT or something like that. But an employee volunteering program, it has these programmatic elements, like a matching incentives and that kind of thing, rewards, recognition, that's all part of the program. And that's important. But where we wanted to go to is something far more like a social movement.
Yeah, really digging into what difference did your program make in the world? What difference did it make for the person, the person or community being served, the person doing the work, and then the company itself? Like, how did this change for the good, for the better, all of these folks? And not just, did we get the requisite number of hours this year done? That's a program. There's still some good. But it's not that transformative energy that I think this gentleman that I spoke for hoped that people would see and carry forward.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with how many hours they got to clock that.
Yeah, day. He doesn't really care about
Couldn't
that.
Couldn't care less.
But you can see how that program can help with the social movement. If the lens, it was like opening the aperture, I think, a little bit in this one, to say, this could be happening a whole bunch of different ways across a whole bunch of different organizations at a whole bunch of different times, but we're all moving towards the same thing. So we looked at social movements like women's suffrage, where it wasn't just one program or one set of programs with one organization that got the work done. You have to hold in your mind that you, with your programs at your company, roll up to something even greater than yourself, that there's a collective action that you need to participate in order to really see things change permanently.
Right.
That's what we're after. We're after a permanence in some of these changes, that we can deconstruct the system. Like the redlining aspects of the system, we pull at that one piece at a time until the whole thing is pulled up. And those may be the little programs that were, each pull is a program, but ripping it up entirely across the entire country, that's a social movement. And if we could get in our minds where we really want to roll up into a social movement, it may change the way we think about it and measure it and talk about it.
100%.
Yeah, that was the first lens.
Then it was participation to agency.
Then it was participation to agency. What do you remember from that?
What I remember is how to get folks to create some sense of awareness beyond the task to the task significance, the what difference would it make. Yeah. When they get buy-in.
That's a good way to say that. I've never said it that way. From the task.
Yeah. Ding!
From the task to task significance.
Right.
Not just what we're doing.
But what matters most about what we're doing.
What matters most?
How do we... How is this better? So it does have threads through to the social movement piece, but it starts to look at the way and the mode of participation. So participating in something is fine. Having someone organized, like we did, we brought people to a space. You did a really great brief, structured it with them, told them what their jobs would be, told them why it mattered. And myself included, we fell into a couple of groupings. Some people hauled out debris in buckets. We were a bucket brigade. Another team went inside and knocked down walls. Another group picked up garbage around the property. And we all had a sense of what the other was doing. And we were connected, even though we weren't doing those tasks. I never went inside the building once. I never went in with the demolition crew. It was a confined space anyway, so it was, we couldn't all go in. But I did have a sense that what they were doing mattered.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt a connection to that. And so in that connection, there starts to be some agency that's grown. When the buckets are coming out of the building and I'm on the line moving buckets into the dumpster, there was a bit of excitement on the line. Like we were talking with each other.
We're getting something done.
Yeah, so we were accomplishing something.
Yeah.
Even though we weren't, particularly on the bucket line where you're just passing it. You're not at the destruction piece.
No.
You're not at the dumpster side.
No.
You just have a ridiculous number of green buckets coming by full of debris. And your only job is to pass it to the next person.
Yeah.
But what I found in terms of agency was how we started to care for each other on that bucket line.
Hmm.
And I watched this whereas a bucket that might have been full of gyprock with lots of brick and stuff might be heavier than the last green bucket. So the person who was passing it to me says, oh, this one's a little heavier.
Mm-hmm.
Watch your back. Mm-hmm. A lift with, don't mm-hmm. be careful. Mm-hmm. There are nails sticking out here of this wood. Be careful. We don't want to see you get hurt. And the people in the experience doing the work started to care for each other. And even though we were told where to go and how to do the work over the hour and a half, the first half an hour ran as designed, sort of by participation standards, it was okay and good. Then we had a midpoint check-in with all of the volunteers. And got some perspective as to what was happening. So we all came out of our spaces. We gathered around the dumpster. We saw that we had one half of two dumpsters full at the halfway mark. And we were encouraged to say, I know it's hot. I know folks are tired. Let's dig in for the second half. And you could, everyone, for the first time when I came out of the back, I could see, oh, I had no idea how full that dumpster was.
Right.
I just knew I was passing a green bucket to the person next
Again,
to me.
Again, a sense of momentum, even building out some more significance of the task in terms of what we can accomplish, which is not a little thing.
But the agency moment was when we gained that perspective at the halfway check-in.
Yeah.
And we knew that we knew how much time we had left, and we knew that we had a dumpster and a half to fill. We all went back, and then without instruction, we created two lines to get the buckets going faster.
Right.
No one told us to.
Right.
We just kind of knew we could probably do this with the resources we had, even though we were tired from the first half. At the end of the experience, half time later, both dumpsters were full. Fascinating to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know I want to unpack the fascination a little bit, because if you're listening to this, you may have heard, yeah, they thought we could do this faster, so they did it faster. What's the big deal, right? Mm. But what we're trying to share is that I could say salt, I could say eggs, I could say pasta, I could say right. bacon, and like, you know what I'm talking about? And you would say, yeah, I understand yeah. those things.
Carbonara.
I could say carbonara. Yeah. And you would say, well, I don't know what that tastes like. Right. And you would taste it. And you would think, oh, meat, that's what that is. When those pepper. Are all put, yeah. Okay. Pepper. Meat's fresh pepper. Ground pepper. He's right. He's that's good carbonara. It's not bacon. What is it? What's that?
Pancetta.
Pancetta. Yeah. It's a great dish. But on its own, these elements that we're all familiar with are just, yeah. they're what they are. But you bring them together in a moment like this and you form a little bucket brigade, and then you give people agency to do it themselves and understand the significance of the task and ask them to double down in a pro-social moment where they dig in and do something that they didn't think they could get done on their own. And the sense of accomplishment, the dopamine that all yes. triggers all the chemicals in the brain that makes it plastic, and potentially we can change the way we see ourselves in the world around us. And that can't be done as well or easily in other ways. This is just a great format for seeing some of that happen. And that's what we talked about. If you bring people to participate, but you think agency is the goal, and you meet people at their highest level of contribution, you're here for the first time, I'll make sure you have a great experience.
Right.
If you volunteer all the time, help me make sure everybody else is having a great experience. And there's way more that can be found in some of the show notes that we've been sharing throughout the seasons and even in this one. But yeah, participation is phenom, but it is a stop on the way to something magnificent, which right. is agency.
Because, ownership, buying into it.
Because we all leave with that, and we can not everybody will decide to, but you now can decide to complement that knowledge and that understanding and become even more of an agent for change. Yeah. Oh, okay. That worked out in the
agent for change. I think that's right. And then it links really nicely to that last lens around moving from helping.
Yes.
That from, helper posture.
So we all begin obviously volunteering, helping. That's a driver that's hardwired into us, but you can go from helping, and we'll put I talk more about it in the video that's attached here. But if you can, the goal is the third lens is to go past helping to a place of belonging, which is where we began the discussion in the first place, which is proximity. It's the principle. Hospitable space is a mechanism to practice the principle with whereby practice is the mechanism to practice the principle of hospitality that guides our interpretation of those around us and so on, leading us to a place where we can recognize and receive belonging when and as it occurs. But in the belonging, we create space by being proximate to the other. Right. So this is the virtuous circle that we hope occurs when people see that we're not helping those people with their problem, but that we're taking belonging posture with posture to say we can bear the burden of this to some degree and maybe co-create solutions to some degree, but with the community, not to or for them.
Leaving that space, I would think for folks who are from Baltimore, the opportunity, so I'm going back to Halifax soon. There's very little room for me to create belonging based out of that particular. I'm not going back
there. You're not going to see Don.
I'll not see him again.
Yeah.
But if I did, I would have to start thinking, if I was from here, I would have to start thinking, I would imagine, just knowing myself and you do it. But how can I be more involved? I think the belonging is, it starts to whet the appetite for, I need more of this belonging. Absolutely. And it's not more of filling dumpsters or breaking down walls, but more connection to how did we get here and how do we solve that? So that the hope that Don had was not, I hope that folks just go down and remember. When you remember, that you do something with it. So eventually, it's not just a hope.
Because you've made these connections. You belong to that community. You belong to them. You've gained a sense of agency.
But Baltimore is us, right. Not them. Not and you us remember, and them.
This is a social movement that could live beyond me or expand
hopefully,
broadly beside me. But there was a sense of addressing the systems and the change that needs to be happening in the systems by putting myself in a place where I can see that the stuff emanating out of me that's keeping that system there. That system lives because I allow it to live in one small little piece. I'm emanating strength to it. And I want to find it and address it in me so that I don't keep giving power to the system.
we spent some time touching on it. We won't get into it here, but we spent some time touching on the synergy between this transformative approach that to volunteering and a restorative approach where I'm spending most of my time working, but that overlap of individual and collective responsibility and accountability, which is what how we talk about it in a restorative approach. And you can see that, yes, there are individual acts that have to be attended to. You want people to move in and take good care of this home mm-hmm. and be good stewards of this new property. Mm-hmm. That is a responsibility that folks have. But there is a collective responsibility, not just to walk away. It is then to do the rest of the work. How do we attract businesses? How do we make sure that
right.
the roads in and out,
right.
the streetlights are fixed?
Anything you need to sustain a healthy
all
community.
All of those step 10 principles
yeah.
have to. So then I could take that next layer of, well, the housing piece is going to be done. Now I need to do advocacy work on these other infrastructure pieces. So what are those spaces to map out the principles behind belonging, which is to think, who's going to do the work? Whose responsibility is it to do the work? And what do we believe will be accomplished if we lean into our responsibility to do that, that individual collective responsibility?
I think that's a good place to leave it.
Sure.
All right.
That's the end of the season.
That's the end of the season. That's it.
All right.
So we'll
kind of a letdown.
Give everybody a heads up on what's coming for next year. I think it'll be really interesting. I think we're going to explore maybe working more closely with the RW Institute and communities there, but we'll give you more information as it develops.
It was pretty cool. I will say this. It was pretty cool at this event to meet people who would say, who knew our stories.
Yeah.
Like we talk to each other, we talk into these mics and we talk into the void. And then to go to this event and say, I love this episode. This made me laugh.
I know.
It feels actually, so weird.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm
yeah.
like, I feel like I know you.
Yeah,
I'm
I know. Like,
that's odd.
Yeah.
But so if you're listening, that wasn't you that I'm talking about. It felt good to hear that people are listening. Very.
I mostly was just validating. Surprised people had heard of it. So
yeah.
That was great.
But that was cool. But maybe we could come away with some live events next year.
So yeah, that'd be fun.
Web presence and do a couple different things. So stay tuned.
We'll see you next season.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.